Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Please take your seats. Join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I know, and the wisdom to know the difference. And our 40-minute speaker, Zach from San Clemente. Yeah.
Howdy. I'm Zach. I'm an alcoholic. I respect this guy up in L.A. He's always got a stopwatch when he's talking, so I'm doing that too, because I'll lose track of myself. I'd like to first thank Jordan for asking me to speak tonight. It's a great honor, and I don't take any AA requests lightly, particularly speaking to a group at a meeting that I respect quite a bit. So thank you, Jordan. You also gave me something to do today. I had to worry about my hair. And seriously, I have one hair. And the problem is, if I don't cut it right, I cut my head. And that looks really bad in front of a room full of people. Like you. Who come up with all kinds of funny things to say to me at the break. So I chose to take my time shaving today and do things the way that I've learned here in AA, which is basically just do the next indicated thing. And I think that's basically how I got here tonight. You know, like I said a couple minutes ago, I do not turn down AA requests. That's what's kept me sober for almost 5.5 years now. I got sober in Pasadena on February 6, 2006. So I'm going to spend the next 38 minutes telling you about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm going to probably lean a little bit more heavily towards what it's like now, because quite frankly, I can't really remember a lot about what it was like. That's how good it's gotten in my case. So I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. I'm from the birthplace, or the birth state, I guess, of this program. I found that kind of interesting when I first got sober. Like, I can't believe anybody in Ohio is sober or ever got sober. There's maybe a few people in here that have drank in Ohio in their lifetime. I'll tell you that I did a lot of it in my lifetime, and it's a great place to get drunk because, quite frankly, there's not a lot else to do, particularly in the winter. You know, here we can wear shorts, we can go down to the beach, you know, sit out at the fishermen's, have sunset drinks. In Ohio, I'm stuck in a smoky bar shooting pool with my fat grandpa. And that's how I learned how to get drunk. So, Dayton, Ohio, really unremarkable childhood other than the fact that I was raised by my mother. My father left when I was 4. He, too, admits to being an alcoholic. You know, it's a beautiful thing today. He and I have a relationship, and I'll draw to that a little bit later in my talk, but you know, alcoholism was present from the beginning, and my mom's side of the family is riddled with it. It's taken out 4 people directly, either through, you know, the deterioration of the disease, the progression of it, or just the stupid stuff that we do, you know. And I can remember really early in my life, people around me trying to conceal their drinking, like my uncles, for instance. And I can remember it always would come up at the holidays, you know. It would always come up at the holidays. Somebody would get lit up, and I really couldn't understand it as a kid, but I liked it. I liked the idea of passing out before we had to do the dishes, you know. Like my uncle Bill was always in bed well before the dishes were getting done on Thanksgiving, and I liked that idea. I didn't like chores. So, the point of my alcoholism, where it began, was long before the drink. Anybody else in here relate with that? Thank you for raising your hand. I appreciate participation in these speaking meetings. It's much more fun. Maybe we'll do aerobics too a little bit later on. I started lying really early in life. My first memory And I did not get this until I got sober, but my very first memory is a lie. I really did not, it never really registered with me. And so I actually went back by doing the steps and working an inventory the way that my sponsor had worked his inventory and the way the book asks us to work our inventories. It came to me that my first memory as a child is a lie. And so if that's not correlated to alcoholism, I don't know what is. And that was a solid 4.5 years before I took my first drink. So it stands out to me too, and it's all over a box of jujubes. That lie is all over a box of jujubes. You know, and I'm here today like 34 years later telling you about it, and it just blows my mind that that's my very first memory, is a lie over a box of jujubes. And it left such an... The impression it left, I have never been able to eat a jujube again and enjoy it. So I've gone to other gummy substances and I've found a lot of other outlets. But honestly, the reality of it is that it really was a traumatic incident in my life. So going to the movies, my dad at this point had gotten remarried. He had two stepchildren. I had two stepbrothers and... Sorry, one stepbrother, one stepsister, but my stepsister was bigger than my stepbrother, so she seemed like a stepbrother when she beat on me. Anyway, we were going to the movies, and it was Jaws, and I think it was Jaws 2, if I'm not mistaken. I have to look it up. Circa 79, 80, I don't know, whatever. Doesn't matter. The bottom line is I bought a box of jujubes after my dad specifically told me not to buy any candy. And then somebody told on me, I think it was my stepbrother, my stepsister, my stepbrother, Kelly. Damn her. Yeah, we'll work on that a little later too. So she told him, and he came to me and he said, "Did you do it?" And I lied. That was the first lie I ever told. And I got away with it for about 30 minutes. But that 30 minutes left a really big impression on me. Like, oh, I can tell you something differently than what actually happened and you'll believe it. And I can get away with it. So that's what really laid the foundation for me. So 30 minutes were up, he figured it out, and I got a bad, bad spanking. I mean, it was so horrific. Like, yeah, Kelly paid for it years later. That's what it boils down to. And... that's where it all started. That's where the lying started and the cheating and the stealing and the, you know, all the stuff that I did. Because I think a lot of you did it too. And, you know, alcohol bounced along about 4.5 years later at his real wedding. So they were getting married. They were actually going to go through the process. They'd been common law or whatever to that point. And he and I got drunk together on his wedding day. I'm 8 years old and I'm getting drunk. So my first drunk was on a mixture of Kahlua, Irish mint or Irish menth, and coffee. And I blacked out, no less. Now, how do you black out on that combo? You know, I don't get it. I laugh about it all the time. It wasn't really funny, though. Actually, I've been asking my father and stepmother for years now since I got sober, can you produce a picture of me from that day? I'd really like to have a picture of the first day I got drunk. And they said no, because we had to put them all away. Everybody was so embarrassed by our behavior. So my dad ended up face down on the dinner table. And I blacked out in the basement. You know, those kinds of incomprehensible, demoralizing moments in life followed me, you know, for the rest of my adolescence into my teenage years. And they got progressively worse. And a lot of it surrounded me drinking. I would say, generally speaking, I can tie almost all of those incomprehensible, demoralizing moments as a child to some kind of event that involved me drinking. And it got worse. And, you know, I'm not saying I was drinking every day as an adolescent. I wasn't. I was a binger. I was really good at it. I figured it out. Like, I could go all week and make everybody to believe I'm fine, there's nothing wrong with me, and then get completely loaded on the weekend. and have some come up with some kind of excuse why I got loaded. And it was always something like, the cabinet was open and I had to drink it or Billy was going to die. You know? Or Kelly made me do it. That was a good one. Kelly made me do it came up a lot. Remember Payback. I realized, though, that it made me feel differently. And that's something that I really wanted to feel at that point in my life. You know, aside from all the other stuff that we go through as kids, I had this feeling inside of me that I was different than everybody else, that I couldn't relate to the people around me. I think I don't want to lay it on the divorce, but I think the stepbrother, stepsister complex got into me. I think my mom and her emotional disconnection because of it all got to me. But generally speaking, I just felt different than everybody else, you know? And alcohol made me feel okay with myself. And then later in life, it made me feel connected to other people. So I really got into booze right away, you know? I was really into it. By the time I got into junior high, it was great. It was like, if I was able to produce alcohol, I had a girlfriend, for sure. And I definitely had some friends. And I definitely couldn't remember what happened. So it was always a good thing for me. You know? And, so fast forward. Whatever. 14 years later. You know, I'm 32. At this point, I'm at a place in my life where I want to kill myself. How do we get from like being an adolescent with a girlfriend and forgetting everything to wanting to kill yourself? The point is, it's alcoholism, you know, in its purest of forms. And it doesn't have to be anything other than me just being dishonest, mostly with myself, for all that time. You know, and I got into this place internally where I wasn't strong enough, I wasn't psycho enough to kill myself, is what it boiled down to. You know, I had the opportunities a few times and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And I was trying so hard. And you know, the moments that would get me there were the moments during that period of time, those years, those demoralizing moments would get me to those places where I'd want to do it in my mind. I was talking to somebody before the meeting about what's going on upstairs, you know? That's where it's all at. It's all up here. It's all in my head. And, you know, I'm in that place, and I just don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. And so this is where I want to jump backwards for a second and say that I'm immensely grateful again to be here. And I want to welcome the newcomers. And I think it's really important to note that, because that's exactly where I was at that point in my life. I was a newcomer. I was totally lost. I had no clue what had happened, how I'd gotten to this place where I wanted to kill myself, and alcohol had something to do with it. So if you're like that tonight, I totally relate to you. And if you have all kinds of demoralizing things inside of you, trust me, I get it, because I've got tons of them too. And this program's given me a solution, the ability to get those things out of me and be able to look at them through a different pair of glasses, I think is what Chuck C. said, and understand that there's a way to live life that doesn't require drinking. So, you know, keep coming back. And the bottom line for me that day when I was thinking about doing it one last time was I needed a solution, and I didn't have it anymore because alcohol had stopped working. It worked through the adolescent phase of my life where I just needed to drown out all the emotions. You know, it worked into where when I was a kid, early teenager, and I got cut from the basketball team and I couldn't deal with that. It worked through that too. You know, it worked through those Thanksgivings with Grandpa and Bill, you know, and dishes. But it didn't work anymore. You know, it had stopped working. It worked through me finding my way through college. It worked through me getting a great job out of college. It worked through me walking from Georgia to Maine nonstop, 6 months. So it worked through bad and good, you know. It allowed me to do all kinds of things, and it kept me from doing all kinds of things. And eventually it got me to a place where there was only one thing left for me to do. I just could not live. I couldn't live anymore the way that I had been living. I could not live anymore. This is the way I'd been living. Let me paint this picture real clearly so that I never forget. That's the most important thing, I think, about sharing our stories. If I share my story, I don't forget. And people that came before me always told me, don't ever forget what it was like. I don't want to ever forget what it was like. Because as soon as I do, I'm thinking about what it's like now. And like I said at the beginning of all this, it's real good. Life's real good. But I don't want to forget what it was like. So this is what it was like at the end. I'm managing a restaurant in Pasadena, California. It's called the Parkway Grill. It's on Arroyo Parkway. It's been there for about 25 years at this point. I've been in restaurants for about 16. If you know anything about restaurant work, it lends itself real well to alcohol. Because you got it, right? Yeah, I got to serve it to you because I got it. And you control it because I'm running the place. And every day I'm drinking before the shift, during the shift, and certainly after the shift. So that's one constant in my life. The other constant is a marriage that's completely failing. Matter of fact, it's failed, and it's at the point now where I'm in so much denial that I'm drinking in order to not see how bad it's failed, to not see her transgressions, to not see my own transgressions. It's gotten so bad that I'm financially bankrupt. I have $0 to my name, and I'm in the hole for close to six figures. It's gotten so bad that my family, my stepsister, stepbrother, Kelly included, have all left me. Literally. My mother died. My father basically is so ashamed by what he feels like he created that he's unwilling to deal with me anymore. My in-laws don't want anything to do with me. I don't have any kids. I don't have any pets. I don't even have plants. I did, though. I used to grow pot. But that's a different story, and that's a different disease, so we won't go there tonight. So anyway, I'm basically alone. And that's a great place to be for a while, because you can just get drunk. Nobody's going to worry about you, you know? But at this point, it's just not cool anymore. It sucks. And like I said, I just wanted it to end, you know? And so I'm doing this job, and I'm wanting it to end. And those two things are constants. And there's one other thing that's a constant. I couldn't put my finger on it until I got sober, and then I realized exactly what that one other thing was, and it was Mark Brown. And you all are like, who's that? And I'm blowing his anonymity because that's my sponsor. And Mark Brown and I worked together every single day for 4 years. From the time I took this job at this restaurant until the time I got sober. And every day Mark Brown would see me get drunk. He'd listen to me talk my pathetic life out to him. And he would try as best he could to make sure that I got home safely and that I had enough to get me through the night. And every day we went through this thing. So, February 5th is Super Bowl Sunday. God, I hope that's the right day. I think it is. February 5th, Super Bowl Sunday. And my friend, another co-worker, Art, his son is now old enough to have his, circumcision. On Super Bowl Sunday. So the party's called the lop off before the kickoff. My job is to get really drunk. My job is to bring the booze for the party. So I leave work loaded with a bunch of booze that's not mine. Amends. Yeah, I need to do that one. So I leave the restaurant with a bunch of booze that's not mine. I continue to drink throughout the day. Then the party comes and I'm obliterated. I'm totally smashed out of my gourd. You know, it's funny. I look back on it and everything I loved to drink was during that day. Like I woke up with mimosas at the restaurant. I woke up at the restaurant. That's a bad sign. If you're waking up at the restaurant, you're probably... Yeah. Woke up with mimosas, I had a Bloody Mary, this is before I left, and I took some champagne with me home, drank some champagne at home, because don't you know I love fine wine. And then made it to the party with maybe a half a handle of bourbon. And God, I can't even believe I made it to the party. So they have Mexican beer and they've got tequila and I've got all that in my system and I'm trying to leave the party at this point. And it's late. It's like halftime. It's late. Luckily, Mark Brown called to make sure that I was okay. I wasn't, so he asked some of our mutual friends if they'd be willing to take me out for dinner and see if they could get me to a place where I might be able to get home. So they took me out to dinner. And those people are Russ and Marie, and I owe Russ and Marie my life. Twice. Lop off before the kickoff, and then another night about 6 months prior that I didn't remember until I did my inventory. More shall be revealed. You know, it's funny. I was totally surrounded by AA before I even got here. I had no clue. I had no idea what AA was. I thought it's where Uncle Bill went when he got locked up for the 15th DUI. I didn't know anything about AA. I was closed-minded to it. I wasn't sure what I needed, but I was pretty sure it wasn't this. But after I came here, I realized I'd been surrounded by AA for so long. The people in my life that were helping me through these moments are all still a huge part of my life, and one of them happens to be my sponsor. So anyway, Russ and Marie got me home. The very last thing that Marie did before she let me walk into my apartment was slap me and say, "Everybody knows you're trying to kill yourself. Why don't you try and not kill anybody else while you're doing that?" And you know, Marie, well, you don't, but I didn't either, actually. That's the funny thing. I didn't know Marie from the side of a barn. She's Russ's wife. She scared me because she was big like Cully. And she just decked me, basically. So, the dying mom, the drunk dad, the incomprehensible, demoralizing, blackout, binging effects throughout my childhood, the bankruptcy, the divorce, even the wanting to kill myself. None of that could get me to stop drinking. And Marie's comment got me to think about things. That was my moment of clarity. Damn it, Marie. You know, I wish you had been there like 18 years before. I wish that would have happened earlier in my life. But I don't regret when it happened, and I know that that's just the way that things go in here. We get here when we're supposed to get here. I truly believe that I got here when I was supposed to get here. And I woke up the next morning, and all that hokey stuff that Mark Brown had been doing for 4 years, the hokey stuff was listening to me and making sure I was getting home safely and calling to make sure everything was cool. That hokey stuff made me think, something's wrong with him. He's not drinking with me. And he seems to be totally happy, and he always seems to have an answer for my problems. And it's usually like, why don't you go clean your room, or pay your bills, or brush your teeth? And I woke up that next morning, and you know, I should have been really hungover, but instead I was determined to find a way to not kill myself, and I was determined to find a way to stop drinking. And I thought there was one person that would know how to do that, and that was Mark. And I also thought he's probably the only person that's going to pick up their phone at 8 a.m. in the morning. Nobody, at that point, nobody wanted to talk to me, that's for sure. So I called Mark, and this is how it went down. I called him, and he didn't answer the first time, which wasn't unusual because Mark sleeps in a lot. He's at work really late, and he generally doesn't get up until 10 in the morning. So it's 8 in the morning and I'm calling him. He's probably waking up looking at his phone saying, whatever, you know. And then I called him right back. And that was something I'd never done at that point in my life for anybody, including my family. You know, you didn't pick up, whatever. You're not worth my time. But I really did not want to drink and I really needed to find a way to make sure that Marie wasn't going to slap me again the next time that she saw me. So I called him right back. And he picked up. And the first thing that he said to me was, "Did I not lock the restaurant?" And I said, "I have no clue. Because I was there this morning when I woke up. I got out just fine. I think you locked it. He said, "Okay, what's the problem?" And I told him, I said, it was the first time that I'd ever said this to anybody. I said, "You know what, Mark? My life is totally a wreck. And I got to find a way to stop drinking because I'm trying to kill myself." And that's exactly how I said it to him. And I thought that was like, You know, I thought that was like what everybody talks about, you know, in the fifth step when people are always talking about this release. That's exactly what I felt at that moment. I hadn't even gotten into step work. I didn't even know what step work, I didn't even know what AA was at that point, let alone step work. But I felt that release then because I was being completely honest with another person about how bad my life was. And all that burden of how bad that my life was at that point was what was keeping me going back to the bottle for years. Years and years and years. The burden of myself. Isn't that what it says in there? In there being the big book? Burden of self. The burden of myself for years kept me going back to that incomprehensible, demoralizing place. And it put me into this place where I wanted to kill myself. And finally, in that very moment, I realized something I had never felt before. I felt comfortable without alcohol. It's the first time in my life. On that phone call. This is even before Mark said anything. That's the amazing thing about how this thing works, I believe. This thing called honesty and this thing called recovery. And he's, matter of fact, said to me, I know. You know, because he did know. He'd been watching it, and he'd been, at that point, he'd been sober for 20 years. So he knew. And he'd been working a very rigorous program of his own. So he understood what was going on with me. He related to me. You know, I didn't relate to him because he was the weird southern guy that lived in Pasadena and would listen to me and not really tell me anything other than stuff on how to keep me alive. And that just was really strange to me back then. I thought he was trying to rip me off. So anyway, he gave me some simple suggestions, and that's where I want to get into solution, because I've talked a little bit too much about all this other stuff, and that's really why I'm here tonight, is solution. And you know, I'm here because there's a solution to my problem. My problem is me. Okay? My problem is me. And the solution is always following these simple suggestions. And they're not mine. Because mine got me to that place, you know. My simple solutions to life got me to a place where I wanted to kill myself. So I was done running the show, and I didn't get all that stuff about the proverbial white flag and stuff, cease fighting everyone and everything. I didn't get any of that. I just felt it. I didn't know what that meant, that feeling, but I felt it. Like, fine. Tell me what to do, and I'll do it. Started right there, and I haven't stopped doing it since, to the best of my ability. You know, and he told me, I want you to call me every hour for the next day and just make sure that you're checking in, you know, because I was really despondent. You know, I'd been like not able to stop drinking for years at this point. How was I going to stop drinking for an hour? Well, calling him helped me do that for the first day. And then he wanted me to come over to his house after work the second day after I'd been calling him for 2 days every hour. He wanted me to come over and talk to him. And I thought, this guy's definitely going to rip me off. And he didn't, and we got into the big book that night. And I'll never forget how I looked at Mark differently from that night forward. I related to him in a way that, you know, up until that point I thought, this guy's just really cool, he's just listening to me spill and vomit on him every night. But he doesn't relate to me. I never thought he related to me. Different age groups, he's got a master's from USC, I'm a pot grower from Ohio. I mean, I just didn't see the relationship. I didn't see how we could connect. And he busted out the doctor's opinion, and that just that laid it in real heavy to me. Real heavy. That drilled it home. That's exactly where I realized that I am an alcoholic, was in the doctor's opinion. Because like I said, I didn't relate to Mark, and he's telling me he's an alcoholic, and I'm thinking, I am not you, man. There is no way that I'm like you. No way. And sure enough, there is. I am absolutely 100% certain that I am an alcoholic. And that's all that matters. That's all that matters in here. I can't tell you you're an alcoholic. You can't tell me I'm an alcoholic. I need to know that inside of myself in order to get this thing. Because I don't think that if I had come to grips with the fact that that's what I am, that I'd be able to do this stuff. So anyway, we read that, and it was heavy duty, and then he wanted me to write. Then it started. Then this whole thing about writing started, and I used to think that I was good at writing. This is long before Mark. And then I realized that I'm not good at writing and I don't like writing. And that's the whole part about AA that I find so magical. When I do stuff that I don't want to do, it pays off instantly. Like, bam. Like, I just get, it's like John Lennon, instant karma. It's like, bam, right there in front of me. It's just, it happens somehow. It just does. It's magic. It's totally magic. It's sparkly like these stickers here, you know, like everything sparkles. And it's like the whole thing I chased when I was doing mind-altering substances. It's that kind of stuff. And so he wanted me to write, and so I wrote. And then, you know, after about 5 days of doing this stuff, he finally took me to a meeting. My very first meeting was on a Sunday night. The It's in the Book meeting. It is, too, by the way. If you're newcomers, all you old-timers know it, but it is in the book. And it's in Pasadena. It's at a Presbyterian church on Colorado Boulevard, corner of Colorado, and what is the other street there? It doesn't matter. Look it up in the directory and go. It's a great meeting. It's very similar to our meetings here at Aragon on Monday and Friday nights. There's a community there. And I walked in and I felt cold because we were walking and it was February and I didn't have a coat on. And I felt really cold. And I remember how warm the room felt. And that was because somebody had been making coffee. And there was like the coffee smell. And these are the things I remember. And I remember this weird dude named Fritz. He had a feather in his hat and he had this like these overalls that were filthy and he had this backpack. And Fritz ended up being this literary genius that's a poet, and we got along really well, and I used to drive him home after these meetings. And I just, these are the things I remember from my first meeting. And the most important thing I remember is that I felt like I was home. You know, I really did feel like I was home. And so if any of this is sounding familiar to anybody in here, good. And if all of you are still awake, then great. I've done my job for at least 31 minutes. So you've got 9 more minutes to go with this solution stuff. So after all that, you know, it's in the book meeting. They kind of took me under their wing. They gave me commitments right away. I started cleaning up cigarette butts, making coffee, putting the chairs away. And, you know, I was just doing the stuff because that's what Mark suggested that I do. And he had what I wanted, so I did it, you know, and that grew. And then I started finding out that there were more meetings than just It's in the Book. I thought that was the only meeting at first. Funny how that isn't the only meeting. And Pasadena's got a lot of sobriety. For those of you that have been to meetings there, you know what I'm talking about. I don't even remember. There's got to be, like, within Pasadena, there has to be 40 meetings a day, literally. So I didn't have any excuses. I started going to the 202 Club, took commitments there. And then, you know, life got good. A couple years rolled by. I got out of that job at the restaurant. I got a new career. This career started taking me all around the world. You know, the funny thing about this new career is that my grandfather, not the drunk one that I used to aspire to be, but the one that passed away before I got to know him, he made hand tools for a living. His son, my father, is not mechanically inclined at all, doesn't even know what a hammer is or how to use it. Somehow that whole hand tool thing skipped ahead, and one of the promises in my life is now I also make and sell tools for a living. And I just find that really magical, you know, and that wouldn't have happened if I didn't have this program. So there's so many things. I mean, my journey has been shockingly similar to what it says in the Big Book about, you know, trusting God, cleaning house and carrying the message, and these things will come to pass, you know, the promises. And it really has happened in my life. You know, I branched out of Pasadena for meetings. I've been to meetings all over the world. I've been to meetings in China. That's a trip, let me tell you. Not because they're in Chinese. That'd be kind of cool too, though. But because there's so many expats and Europeans and Australians who are descendants technically of this original group from Ohio, which is technically where I'm from, and it's all kind of branched out in this big worldwide thing, you know? And I'm talking about the sticks in China. I'm not talking about the big cities. So it's really neat. I've had the fortune of working with other people, and that to me is the greatest gift of this program. I didn't buy that when I first got here. I remember hearing that stuff early on and thinking to myself, I've never once really wanted to root for anybody else. Why should I start now? But that's the kind of selflessness that I've learned because of you folks in here. And because of the stuff that you've given to me selflessly. And working with other people has been an amazing journey. It forces me every day to actually work a program. That's the most important thing. I want to pass this down. This is, I believe, the most important part of my solution, is a foundation based on these simple things. And this one blows me away. It still blows me away to this day. It's the phone thing. I'm back to the phone. I'm like phone-centric now. It's timer and everything. It's God. But the phone has kept me sober for 5.5 years. And I'll tell you why. Because Mark has asked me every day to call him for 5.5 years. And he's always made a little amendment to that, except when you can't because you're in China or wherever. And so I don't get hung up on this stuff. Remember, progress, not perfection. I don't get hung up on when I can't call him, because he always told me, call me as soon as you can when you can't call me. And that kind of stuff has kept him sober for 5.5 years. And that's the kind of stuff that keeps me sober today, because the people that I too am friends with do the same thing for me. And I can't tell you, like, there's been two amazing points in my sobriety related to the phone. One is with Mark, where I was calling him because I had a problem. I think my problem was that my Bengals had lost again, and I was furious about it, and I wanted to blow some steam. The funny thing about that was he picked up the phone, and remember, this guy's got a lot of time, and he says to me, you know, I'm standing in front of the Hilton here in Pasadena, and I'm thinking about going in and having a Coke. And he told me the next day that he really wasn't thinking about going in to have a Coke. But the reality was that my phone call stopped him from going in to do what he was thinking about doing. You know, and that's the simple stuff, I think, because anybody can get there. I've seen it happen. I don't want it to happen to me, so I keep doing the simple stuff. Funny thing happens a couple of years after that. I have a monumental meltdown in my life. You know, this woman that I've been seeing for a while decides that I'm not good enough, so she stops seeing me, and it just blows me to pieces. And she does it in a real social setting, in real social fashion, in this setting amongst friends, and it was catastrophic in the moment to me, and I'm thinking about drinking. I'm literally thinking about drinking over this. So I get in my car, and I'm going to drive all the way from Santa Monica to Pasadena to go to this place I used to drink. And somewhere along the way, one of the guys I've been working with calls me. So, you know, a lot of people chalk that stuff up to coincidence. I don't. I was also talking about coincidence before the meeting. I don't find that there are any coincidences now in my life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen miracles happen. Those two happened to me and people directly related to me. So if you're new, welcome. And get a sponsor that has a program like what you want. And if you're going to get a sponsor and it's a program like you want, it probably doesn't involve drinking and, you know, all that other stuff. So look for somebody that's got some time, that's done this stuff, and that you can relate to. And if you can't find anybody like that, just find somebody and start working these steps and start doing what's suggested. Simple suggestion is what keeps me sober today. It's simple stuff. Jordan suggested I come and lead this meeting tonight, and I'm honored, like I said, but it's kept me sober one more day. It didn't even cross my mind today to get loaded. It hasn't for a long time. I'm almost positive that I'm not going to feel like it later tonight because of this. And I'm absolutely immensely grateful and blown away by that, too. You know, I couldn't find a good reason to stop drinking, like I said. I never could. I never could find a good reason to stop drinking. And then all of a sudden, the obsession's lifted for me. It's just gone. Where'd it go? And not only that, then my life gets better. Like I said, I'll wrap it up with this. My life has gotten so much better, and I attribute it all to this program. I'm indebted with my life to this program because of it. There's a wonderful woman in my life today with two wonderful children, and I'm able to be present in their life, and I feel comfortable around them, being myself. They know who I am. Her family knows who I am. They know I'm in recovery. There's nothing awkward about my life with them. I have a great job, like I said. I'm getting out of bankruptcy one day at a time. I'm in a place where I feel, even though we're in this, whatever we call this thing that we're in right now, I feel pretty secure. I have my family back in my life. My father's been sober for 5.5 years as well. He's not working a program, but he is working with me, and that's been immensely gratifying for both of us. You know, I have a lot of friends. This is another thing I talked to somebody about during the break. This is really important. I have a lot of friends in my life that I felt like I was going to have to go back and make amends to and then clear some stuff up. When I went and did that, it was like we started anew. You know, I have this great group of people in my life that I would have never known had I not gotten sober, and you're all in the room tonight. There's a lot of people around the world that I consider friends in these rooms. These are all things I've gotten as a direct relationship to this program. The most important thing I've gotten is I can look myself in the face, in the mirror, I can look myself in the eye, I can look myself up and down, I can see myself for what I am today. I'm an alcoholic, I got all kinds of issues, but I have a solution to those things today. I'm absolutely 100% convinced that this program can work for anybody that chooses to do it. Thank you very much for your attention.